It says, introduce the speaker or the person who's to introduce the speaker. I was asked to do this because I met the speaker a number of years back, and I heard his story a number of times, actually just about a month ago, maybe. This guy had been a big inspiration. I remember there was the first Friday speaker meeting a year ago in November when I was chairing this meeting, the first Friday speaker meeting, and I had seen him speak at The Rock, and I thought, you know what? I don't know who else got something out of that, but I got a lot. And he's got one heck of a message for people that are new in recovery, especially in recovery. He covers a wide variety of things that he's been through and things that you may be going through now. I mean, I don't want to certainly tell his story, but he goes drinking and drugging and just you name it. There's a lot of things that he's got a lot to say about. So with that, I'm just going to let him come on up and tell his story. Robert, come on up and talk to us, bud.
Well, that's quite a lot to live up to. My name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Sam. I want to thank the Alumni Association here at Ridgeview for asking me to speak. And it's great to see all the people here. It's great to see new people here. And I think everybody's got to be here on day two, but you don't always get to come up and read. So Matt, takes a lot of courage to follow through on that. And if you keep doing those kind of things and following suggestions, maybe you'll be up here telling your story. Who knows? You're probably not looking forward to that. So before I get going, let me just sort of gauge the sobriety time here in the room. How many people in here have less than 6 months of sobriety? If you could raise your hand. A bunch. Great. That's wonderful. Congratulations on being here. Similar question, same type of answer. How many people are in their last 6 months of sobriety? This is a sharp crowd. Usually a few people raise their hands. They just want to participate. But I can ask that question, and I have a good reason for asking that, because my sobriety date is April 10th, 2001, and that's when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I say I came back because that wasn't my first time here. See, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit earlier, and I was here for 10 years going in and out and in and out, and I was in my first 6 months of sobriety and my last 6 months of sobriety at the very same time, and I didn't even know it. And I would go to meetings, and I'd hear things like, meeting makers make it. And I made a lot of meetings, but I did not have a spiritual experience. I did not have a spiritual awakening as a result of making meetings. I had a spiritual experience as a result of taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I'd hear things like, if you can just make it to midnight, it's only 3 hours and 50 minutes, then you're a winner. Well, I tell you, my fists were clenched, my knuckles were white, my teeth were grit, and I did not feel like a winner. See, I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. And so during that time, during those 10 years, I was going in and out and in and out, and you do not have to do that. There's a lot of people, if I asked people how many people have one white chip, I'm sure there'd be a bunch of people. You don't have to do that, but if you're coming back, let me stand here to let you know that you can come back and do the kind of things that I did and get better. And you know, I'd come to meetings like this and I'd hear the things that you read. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. See, the problem I had was, first of all, I did not know what you had. I did not know y'all had found a way to stay sober, to have a peace of mind while you're not drinking. I didn't know that. And even when I knew that, it says, are you willing to go to any lengths? That was the challenge I had. I wasn't willing to go to any lengths. I was not willing to put my sobriety at the top of the list. And so I go in and out and in and out. And, you know, I had a variety of consequences. And consequences, fear, knowledge about alcoholism and drug addiction, all that stuff. None of that stuff helped me get sober. But I got to tell you, the one thing, I can boil it down to one word and one word only, it made all the difference in the world in me getting sober. When I boil it down to that one word is sponsorship. I got a sponsor. And that was a big change for me. And this is a guy that relied on God. He trusted God. He talked about God. He told me we were going to take the steps. And in the process of doing that, I'd have a spiritual awakening. And that I, too, would be able to do the same kind of things he did and be to stay sober. And he showed me a lot of things. He took me to meetings. He showed me the kind of things that went on, and I'll get to that a little bit. But I'd say one thing that was really important that he demonstrated to me, and I'm not the kind of guy that quotes the big book, but on page 44, it says, If when you want to stop drinking, you find that you can't, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you're probably suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. Only a spiritual experience. See, I needed to get one of those things. I did not have one of those things by going to meetings, not having a sponsor, not doing the other things that I've learned to do now. You know, my home group is the Fit Tradition Group. We meet on Thursday nights, have a big book study. It's at 8 p.m. It meets at Briarcliff United Methodist Church. We have a speaker meeting on Saturday nights. It's at 7 p.m. We have a 15-minute speaker, a break, then a 45-minute speaker. Love to have you join us. It's sort of on the other side of town. If you're in residence here, you probably can't get there and get back in time. But once you're out and doing the things you're supposed to do, we'd love to have you join us. It's been important for me to have a home group. Been a member of a home group since I got a sponsor. So I was asked to tell my story here. Let me tell you a little bit about me. I was actually born right here in Atlanta. I was born downtown Atlanta. It's Atlanta Medical now. It's Georgia Baptist. My parents were married. They took me home, and I was shown all sorts of love. And I was given great educational opportunities, good religious training, taught right from wrong. I mean, really, I had not a thing to complain about. And yet, when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have blamed my parents for my problems. I'd have, you know, laid all my troubles at their feet. And they were just loving parents, doing the best they could to give me a good education and point me in the right direction. You know, I remember growing up, I felt a little bit different. I sort of had this reddish hair. I wore glasses for a while. I looked a little bit different than people, or at least that's the way I felt. As an adolescent, I don't know that it was any different for an alcoholic than other adolescents. Sometimes I felt outside of the crowd. Might not have been the best athlete, did okay in school. And so I felt a little bit different. But there came that one day. I'll never forget. I was 15 years old when I was with my buddy, Rex. We were sitting in front of the high school gym. This was over in the Chastain Park area. And I can remember it like it was yesterday. And the McClellan brothers pulled up. These were a couple guys from the Roswell area. And they were the kind of guys you looked up to. I was 15 then. Rex was 15. But Jim and John were 16 and 17 years old. They had long hair. They played in a van. They talked about going out with women. They talked about having sex with women. Well, I'd had sex before. It had always been menage a uno. But these were the kind of guys we wanted to be like. And I can remember they opened that door to that Volkswagen van and said, y'all want to go out and have a couple of beers? And Rex and I looked at one another. We jumped in that van. And I was thinking about when my dad drank. He'd have a couple beers when he got home. He'd have a couple drinks. He'd read the paper, eat dinner, go to bed, get up, go to work the next day. I was thinking I was going to have a couple beers. And I jumped in that van. And one of the things that made me alcoholic happened to me that day. I'm thinking I'm going to have a couple beers. I ended up drinking six or seven. I liked what it did for me. Man, I drank more. I couldn't control how much I drank. No big problems, but it was fun. It was sort of like any of that anxiety, any of that fear that I had, that adolescent stuff going on, unable to talk with people, it went away. We had a blast that night. Then the second thing that made me alcoholic, or a budding alcoholic anyway, happened as well. Next day when I got up, I thought, this is fun. We should do this again. Now, I don't think on that fateful day that I took that first drink that I was necessarily, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but I think on that day an alcoholic was born, man, because I started drinking on a regular basis. Drinking age was 18. It's relatively easy to get alcohol for teenagers then. But also, this was just after Woodstock. And lots of stuff was going on around Atlanta and all around the U.S., probably around the world. And I can remember I was driving around with a friend, Drew, and we were in his Triumph, and we were motoring over the Chattahoochee River. And there used to be this big event in Atlanta called the Raft Race. It was the WQXI Raft Race, and there's a few people who are recognizing that name. But it's a big event put on by Budweiser. 300,000 people go down the Chattahoochee River. It was not really a race. It's a great excuse to go out and get drunk. That's what it was. And you go past River Bend and look over the left, and there's lots of people over there having a different party, you know? They were just getting it on. So it was a wonderful time, and we were just out there participating in it, but we're driving this TR6 going over the Chattahoochee, and I can remember it like it's yesterday. I sit in the passenger seat, Drew says, Robert, look in the glove compartment. I open the glove compartment, this bag of weed fell out. It was in a plastic bag, and it was that kind that wasn't a Ziploc. It was the kind where you lick the plastic bag like you used to do, and it had that old 70s pot with seeds and stems in it that pop and crack when you smoke it, and it burns your shirt and things like that. And I don't know that I fell in love with marijuana, but I think it enhanced the effect of alcohol, you know? And so I started smoking that stuff. When you start doing that kind of thing, other things come over the horizon. And I was dating this woman, and her name was Sherry. And I'll never forget, I'd been going out with her for a little bit. We went over to her house, and her bedroom was in the back of the house. Her parents happened to be up front, and she invited me to the back of the house. And I thought, this sounds good. We go into her bedroom, she shuts the door and locks it. It's looking better. Then she goes through this ritual that I'd maybe read about or seen on TV, but I'd never been there when it happens, and she pulls out this mirror and dumps some white powder on it, chops it all up, spreads it out into a couple lines, picks up a straw, and looks at me, and bats her brown eyes, and says, "Robert, if you'll snort this with me, I'll let you feel my boobs." Well, you can imagine what happened. I ended up drinking and doing drugs for the next 25 years. And though we're in a treatment center format, you may have noted I identify as an alcoholic. I really don't identify as an addict, and if you do, that's fine with me. But I generally sort of want to point out that in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes people are concerned about drug use. And I've found that it seems to be a lot of worry all about nothing. Because most alcoholics I know, every now and then, utilize drugs in between their drinking binges. And there's times when, you know, I had to apologize for my drug use. I had to apologize for my parents when I got caught with drugs. I had to apologize to teachers and school administrators when I was merely following through on some of the economics I learned about purchasing, distribution, sales. And they saw no humor in that. And of course there's police, and I'll mention that in a little bit. But when it gets down to being an alcoholic, I'm absolutely positive I'm an alcoholic because I have this special relationship with alcohol. And if, for example, tonight, as I keep talking, I may get thirsty, I may drink this whole water. And I may drink half of it, may drink all of it, but I can tell you what will not happen is when this meeting is over, I'm not going to go buy a couple of cases of water and lock myself in a hotel. That uniquely happens to me with alcohol, with beverage alcohol. And I know there's alcoholics here and there's addicts here and some that do both, but I am a keen observer. I watched a lot of things going on. I was over there by the coffee and I could tell the alcoholics from the addicts, and it's real easy to tell. See, I was getting some coffee, and the alcoholics shake this sugar or the sweet and low like this, and the addicts you guys in treatment, we're watching you, see? But you know, alcohol sort of turned on me, and you know, I started running into troubles. There's troubles at home, of course. Parents would get upset when you miss curfew, show up drunk, things like that. But the bigger trouble came from the law. So I'm 17 years old, I'm playing a baseball game in Athens, and we're heading down to Jekyll Island. I'm with my buddy David. We're in my family car, and we're supposed to meet some other friends from high school down there. So we take off, we're driving down and drinking. We have a cooler full of beer. He's 18, I'm 17, I believe. And so we're having a good time, drinking beer. And David says to me, "Robert, why don't you let me drive?" And I'm thinking, okay. And I think David might have felt maybe I was a little bit too drunk to drive. But anyway, I let David drive, and I'm sitting in the passenger seat. We're having a good time. And we end up in Camden County. And if you know the geography of Georgia, you would probably wonder, how do you get into Camden County on the way to Jekyll Island? Because it's south of where Jekyll Island is. But anyway, David gets pulled over. He was not as good a drunk driver as he thought he was. And so we get arrested, we end up in the Camden County Jail, and so we have to call our parents. And David lets me know his parents are out of town, so I call my dad. My dad was expecting a phone call from me saying I'm there safe at Jekyll Island. I'm calling from the Camden County Jail saying I need bail money, and that was not the call he expected. And he was upset, but he was clear. He said, "I'm going to send you some money. going to Jekyll Island. When y'all leave there at noon, I want you here at home at 5 o'clock sharp. And I knew he meant business. So we went on. We came up with some story to our classmates. I don't know what we told them. But we left there, came home. We pulled up at 5 o'clock, and I'll never forget, we pull up at my parents' house, and my parents and David's parents are sitting on the front porch. And they read us the Riot Act. They talk about drinking and driving, the problems you can have. My parents talked about my cousin Victor and stuff like that. But they sort of wanted to scare us into quitting, and they threatened us and all that kind of stuff. And David made a commitment, though, to not drink. And he is able to not drink. I made a commitment to not drink. And if you'd watched us drink, we were knocking them out left and right, one after the other, both getting loaded. The big book talks about different kinds of drinkers. It talks about the hard drinker that, given a sufficient reason, can stop or moderate. That's the way David was. It also talks about the real alcoholic. The next week, I'm drinking again. The thoughts of the problems I had quickly left my mind. You know, I got out of high school, and there were other run-ins with the law. There's the public drunkenness kind of things. You know, you have to go to the bathroom at the wrong time, and the police are there, and it's embarrassing. And it's really embarrassing calling your parents for those kind of things, too. But I make it off to college, and I went to this college in North Carolina. It's a four-year college, and I sped through it in 60 months. I had a few educational challenges along the way, but, and people ask me, they say, you know, people that are active alcoholics, I don't see how you can make it through college. You know, I couldn't even get started. But see, I could take tests. You give me a multiple choice test, it's like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. You can 50-50 cut out two and, you know, come up with a pretty good answer. And you give me a written test, and I'm okay at that. I can come up with stuff to write. But you give me an oral test, and I've got three or four people up here talking, and I got the other guy outnumbered, you know? So I was able to get through college. But when I got out of college, I found out there was one test I could not pass. That was a field sobriety test. And I had the occasion to take it three times in the early 80s for good reason, and I got arrested on all three. You got DUIs, there's car wrecks involved, and all that kind of stuff. And I was in trouble. I was actually doing pretty good, making some money in sales. And so I hired an attorney, and we were going to go in front of the judge. And I'd paid him a bunch of money. And he said, whatever happens, don't, you know, you don't need to be talking to the judge. And I knew that. That's what I was paying him for. He says, but if he asks you a direct question, I nod my head, you can answer it. So anyway, this judge is looking through the three specific tickets for driving under the influence of the car wreck. But he also had this big tractor feed printout, like they had in the old days, in the 20th century. And there's all these other arrests, all alcohol related, more or less. And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I thought, no, it's really all those Quaaludes I was eating is a real problem, you know? But you know, there's concrete evidence. And when you end up in places like the police station, in front of judges, in the hospital, this is evidence to the outside world that you have a problem. It was not convincing to me. A great follow-up question for him would have been, maybe you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you should go get treatment. Go to a place like Ridgeview or some other treatment center. But see, the fix was in. I paid my attorney. I don't know what was going on between him and the judge. But in essence, you know, I dodged the bullet. So I leave there and I continue drinking, and I was doing all other kind of stuff that people were doing at that time, lots of drinking and cocaine and Quaaludes. And I had this one night where it was just, it actually was like from a Thursday through a Sunday. And I got up on a Sunday and I was just tore up. I couldn't do it anymore. I knew that something had to change. I'd grown up going to church, and I thought, maybe I'll go back to church, try and quit all this drinking and drugging. So I go back to church, and I'm trying to quit, and you know, I was able to kick that cocaine and Quaalude habit. And the way you do that is you buy a bottle of Jack Daniels every day. It diminishes the need for all of the other things. And so I was drinking pretty heavily, but I was going to church. I ended up meeting my first wife. I'm here with my current wife, Carrie, and I've only had two, I do want to say. But I met my first wife, Teresa, and I met her at church. She's a good woman, and she didn't mind drinking, but she didn't like drunkenness. She'd had a dad who drank to excess, and but she didn't mind drinking. Here's the kind of thing that would happen with me, is I would say, you know, I'm just going to stop at the bar. I'm going to see Sean, and we're going to watch one baseball game, maybe through the third inning, and head home at 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. And I'd tell my wife that. We'd plan on having a late dinner, and she'd fix dinner. It'd be ready for me. But 8:30 would come, and the baseball game would be tied. And I'm having a good time talking to Sean. I meet some other people. We're doing a few shooters. The next thing I know, it's 11 o'clock. The game's over. And I've already missed dinner, so I decide, what the heck, we'll end up closing this bar down. May go downtown after that. Who knows what's going to happen? Now, I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I show up in treatment, and I'm telling stories like this. And I'm saying, you know, my drug and alcohol use really isn't hurting anybody. It's only hurting me. But think about that poor woman sitting at home who had fixed dinner that has to put it up. Think about my parents bailing me out of jail. Think about my brother and the problems I'd caused him. The big book tells me selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of my troubles. But I can't see it in my active alcoholism. I just can't see that kind of thing. But that woman put up with things. There'd be periods of sobriety, and we were trying to have children, and she's having problems having children, so she goes to the gynecologist, but they say you got to check everyone out, so I go to the doctor. And meanwhile, I find out I need to have this surgery. It's an elective surgery, but I need to have it, and I want to be healthy, be a good parent, all that kind of stuff. So I have this surgery, and it's an abdominal surgery, and I don't think too much about it because I go in, say, in February, and it's not going to be till May. And, you know, it gets close to surgery time. I have to go in to get some blood work, some follow-up work with the surgeon, and I start thinking about this and ask the surgeon, isn't this going to be painful? And he says, yes, it is. That's why we're going to keep you in the hospital a couple of days so we can make sure the pain's not too bad. I said, well, what about when I get out? Will the pain be gone? He says, no, it's going to be painful. I said, well, do you have a treatment for that? And the doctor says, yes, it's narcotic medication. I said, that sounds good, you know. And so what happened is I started taking these pills, and I found that if you took 4 every 2 hours instead of 2 every 4 hours, or maybe even more, you would get this sense of ease and comfort, sort of like you get from drinking. And here's what happened to me is I came up with a plan. Now, if you're new and have a plan, you need to tell us your plan. I see people have plans here. Here was my plan. So my plan was, you know, when you're popping these pills, you really can't smell the alcohol. And I traveled then, so when I was traveling, I'd drink. When I'm in town, I'd pop the pills. When I'm traveling, get loaded, drink the way I want to, and I'm town, pop the pills. Inherently, there's problems with this because you sort of overshoot the mark with the pills and you're laying on the floor. They may not be able to smell alcohol, but they know something's up, you know? And there's other problems. I was noticing on that pill bottle, it said, do not take with alcohol, and I inferred from that that maybe alcohol will improve the effects of these pills. And so I thought, I'll wash these down with a couple of beers. Well, I had not been around AA, had no reason to know about anything of this stuff, like this phenomenon of craving that is even pictured up there on the wall that you guys talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'd drink down the couple beers of those pills, and after about 30 minutes, I was getting thirsty. Man, I wanted more beer. I wanted something, you know? And so I'd look through the fridge, and maybe we're low on milk. I'd say, man, I got to go to the store. And so I'm leaving, going out, doing more drinking. And so this whole plan, you can see how it's doomed to failure at the beginning. And, of course, on the road, I decided to drink and pop in a few pills. But there was other problems with this whole plan, too, because I found that I was popping a lot of pills, and the surgeon was willing to refill them. And I needed more than he was giving me. So I mentioned my primary care physician. He acknowledged the level of pain that abdominal surgery can cause, and he prescribed some for me. And I solicited other doctors to help me with this challenge I was having, and so before I knew it, I had several doctors giving me prescriptions. But doctors also have this concern about the health and well-being and potential addictive qualities of these pills they're writing, and so they started cutting me off. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm a keen observer of society, and I'd noticed that one of these doctors left their prescription pad in the back of the office, and I thought these pads may come in handy. And I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a pharmacist, but I do write prescriptions. And so I started writing prescriptions. Before I knew it, you know, I'm writing them every day. And if you break any law enough, sooner or later, you get caught. And that's what happened with me. And so I got caught for forging prescriptions, and I could have gotten, I hired an attorney, I could have gotten out on a first offender violation, but I had no defense against first string. I wasn't doing A, didn't do treatment, didn't do anything. Next thing I know, within 3 months, I was arrested, and I couldn't believe what I was arrested for. They arrested me for assault and robbing a drugstore. And it seemed to me that that was overshooting the real circumstance of what happened. However, I had to face the facts, and so I went to my attorney, and he said, there's a couple things we've got to do here. One, and this is like 1991, 10 years before I got sober, he says, one, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, Alcoholics Anonymous, how's this going to help? He says, we've got to demonstrate you're doing something about these problems. Look at all these arrests for drinking. Look at this arrest you've got going here around prescription drugs. There's all sorts of history that I probably don't even know about, and he is right. So that's when I went to my first AA meeting. I'll never forget, it was a Sunday night. It was in January. It was in Cobb County in East Cobb. And I went into a room, not exactly like this, but there's linoleum floor, and there's round tables, there's a church, and the chairs were all pushed up against the table. And it was Super Bowl Sunday. And I did not feel happy, joyous, and free, I can tell you. But anyway, that was my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, our third tradition, it was read early, says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. It would have been great if I had a desire to stop drinking. A is sort of a waste of time if you don't want to stop. I hope everybody in here has that desire. That's a key thing. I didn't have that. But the attorney told me something else, and this was even more troublesome. He says, Robert, right now they have you charged with four felonies. We'll be able to plea bargain it down to two. Two of these type of felonies is 10 years. We'll be able to maybe squeeze it down to 2 years, but it's going to be 10 years, two to serve, and you're going to prison. And I said, prison? I'm a jail guy. I'm not a prison guy. He did not see the humor in that. So I was going to AA, following the directions of my lawyer as if he were a sponsor. I'd like to say that I stopped, but you know, the trial date came around, it was in September, and it was at a time when there was overcrowding in the jails. They looked at the assault and they looked at the robbery, and it wasn't an armed robbery or anything. And I was able to dodge the bullet one more time. I didn't have to go to prison. I was on probation, intensive probation, probation for 10 years, but it was a mess. So I dodged that bullet. Even when I was on probation, I found ways where I could still drink and I could still pop a few pills and do things to treat my untreated alcoholism. And this was at the expense of going to jail for 10 years. That's what the district attorney told me. If you violate, you're going to prison. We read, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It is. If you're here and you're new in treatment, do what they ask you. Join AA and join us, and we'll be glad to show you what we do. But I was potentially really in trouble. But I made it through that probation period of time, and it got to the point of April 2010, my sobriety date. During this time that I've been talking about, we were not able to have kids. We adopted a son. We adopted a son, Stuart, is 1987. I can remember the day that we went to pick him up. He is 2 days old, and my former wife and I drove down to Thomasville, Georgia to pick up that baby. And that was a time when I remember, I said, I'm going to quit. This is one of those times I'm going to put my foot down. This is it. I need to not be drinking. I need to not be doing drugs. I need to be a good parent. This is a time to change. And I think everyone in this room knows that they've had those moments where they want to change, and yet we pick up that child, bring him back. It's a beautiful baby, one that we had wanted, one that we got. When I get home, my parents are there, my in-laws are there, and I loved everybody that was there. There's a lot of activity. The baby's crying, diapers are changing. I'm getting sort of that anxiety, that tightness. The book describes it as restless, irritable, and discontent. And I knew how to ease that. You know, that was a time I wanted to quit, but I couldn't quit. And you know, it rolls around to April 2001. We're down in Tampa, Florida on spring break, down there with Stuart. He's now 14 years old, and we're having a good time. My wife gets a call from her work. She's asked to return home. So she comes back on a Wednesday night. I get back on Wednesday night. Stuart doesn't have school till the next Monday. But I get into town. I meet the guys that I usually meet on Wednesday night at the Buckhead Saloon. We get really drunk. I get up the next day, and I thought, if my wife's going back to work, I'll go back to work, save my vacation days. And so I do that, and I go into work. I've got a pretty bad hangover, but if you're an alcoholic like me, you can function with a hangover. You go ahead, plow through it. You got to work, got to make the money, you got to do what it takes. But one of the ways that I'd ease that is I might would take these pills like I talked earlier. So I go to work, take some pills, and I didn't really know what was going on. I was sort of in a fatigued state because of the big hangover, and I might have taken one too many. But next thing I know, I'm getting really dizzy. This is not the first time this kind of thing has happened. Next thing I know, it's boom. And I'm on the floor, and I'm sort of shaking like this. And I hear, call 911. Robert's gone down. And so they call an ambulance. And I get hauled off to Piedmont Hospital. And so I'm in the hospital. You come to, and you're always looking up at lights and, like, nurses with masks on, and they're saying things like, breathe, Mr. Bell, breathe, you know. And I have to evaluate, did I have enough fun to make it to the ER, you know? The answer is usually no. So anyway, I sort of come to, I'm telling the nurses what had happened. They say, you know, you show them the ER, you don't have, like, your car. You can't jump in the car and head home. So I have to call someone. I call my former wife, and I'll never forget what she says to me. And I tell her what's happened. This is a woman who's picked me up in jail before, got me out of the hospital, got me out of detox a number of times. And she says, Robert, is there any hope? When you're being asked, is there any hope, that's about the time it is to join Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I didn't know if there's any hope or not. She comes to pick me up. I'm visiting with a doctor. You know, he's got these discharge papers. And he's telling me the things I need to go home, rest, plenty of fluids. He says, the nurse said you took some pills and didn't even count them. He said, weren't you afraid of an overdose? I said, no, doc, I'm afraid of an underdose is what I'm afraid of, you know. So he shook his head, and so I jump in the car, and I got home. And my former wife was really a kind woman. When I got home, there was a packed bag. And she said, it is not fair to me, and is not fair to your son, Stuart, and my dad was living with me at the time, it's not fair to your dad, for you to keep trying AA. So we found a place for you to go. So they packed me up, sent me this place out in East Georgia called Penfield. I got there 2 days later. I was shaking because I had detox. So they send me off, and I end up in Peachford. I'm in Peachford detoxing. And so I got a question for you, and I think I know the universal answer to the first one. How many people have been in the mental institute? Can you raise your hand? It's almost universal. Okay, how many people have been to jail, if you'll raise your hand? A lot of the same people. So anyway, I'm in Peachford while I'm there. A couple of quick stories. One, I'm in there, and a counselor draws me back to a room, and he's talking to me. He says, Robert, have you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I think everyone in the mental institute has been to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't sure, but I said, yes. He said, did you take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I think everyone in their heart of hearts knows they've taken the 12 steps. They know if they've gotten on their knees and done that third step prayer, if they've written a four step, they've shared it with their sponsor, asked God for help with character defects, made amends, straightened out their life. I'd not done any of that stuff. So I said, no. He said, did you have a sponsor? I said, name only. He said, did you read the big book? I certainly hadn't studied it. He said, well, what did Bill finally do when he got sober? And it relates to directly what's going on here. He says, he went back to the hospital where he got better and told the patients of his theory of rehabilitation, and that if they wanted to get better, they'd have to do likewise, meaning they'd have to carry the message to the alcoholic and the addict who's still suffering. And that's why guys have been sober a long time come back and help patients here at Ridgeview. But he asked me if I knew what Bill did. I could not identify that. I know about it now. And he asked me this one question. He says, Robert, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you? Well, I'm the untreated alcoholic. I'm ready with a quick answer. He says, no. Go back to the day room. Hang out with your peers. So I went back to the day room, forgot about the whole conversation. Another thing that happened in the mental institute is I can remember members of Alcoholics Anonymous came. They brought in meetings. I can remember they were reading off the title page of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Thousands, it's broad-based, men and women, it's inclusive, recovered to regain our spiritual, mental, and physical health from alcoholism. And they talked about the disease concept, that I'm physically and mentally different from my fellows. And, of course, I sort of filed that away. I didn't think too much about it. But anyway, I get out of there. I go back to this place, Penfield, then end up in this halfway house treatment center on the other side of town, Metropolitan Atlanta Recovery Residences. But while I was there, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened. I went to Peachtree Corners, my first home group. I asked a man to sponsor me, Pat M. And he asked me a number of questions. The key question he asked, he said, you willing to do what it takes to gain victory over alcoholism? And I said, yes. I didn't know what it meant. He says, well, meet me here when the meeting meets. Meet me here on Fridays and Mondays. I said, I'll see you at 8. He said, no, meet me at 7. I said, 7? What are we going to do? He said, well, we have to put up the steps. We have to put up literature. We have to make coffee. We have to get the place ready for the people who are going to show up. See, I thought all these meetings at church, that church staff set all this stuff up. I did not know. And so he showed me about Alcoholics Anonymous. More importantly, he unlocked the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I understood the nature of the disease of alcoholism by studying the beginning parts of the book, the phenomenon of craving. The main problem of the alcoholic centered his mind rather than his body. We did that third step prayer and processed our way through the steps. You know, during this time, I was about 4 months sober. My dad was sick. He'd been living with me. He got an infection in his pacemaker. He went to the hospital. He was not doing well. Now, I can remember I went to visit him on a Saturday. And on that Saturday, he told me this. He says, you know, Robert, there comes a time in a man's life where he has to make peace with God and his fellow man. And that's what he did. He sort of made a sign like that, God and his fellow man. He says, I've done that. I'm ready to meet my maker. And you know, that's what he'd been trying to teach me his whole life. He was described as honest as the day is long, and that was the type of spiritual principle he was trying to teach me. And I have to drink myself into oblivion and come to AA when that's exactly what you taught me, how to get some kind of relationship with a higher power, straighten out things so I can be at peace with my fellow man. And he died a couple days later, Tuesday, and I was there with my brother, his wife, my son, my former wife. We were able to say prayers he'd want to hear and read spiritual literature that he'd want to have read. And I was able to participate and actually do part of his funeral, do the family eulogy that Friday. So I did the family eulogy, and my 15-year-old son, Stuart, got up there and he read the 23rd Psalm, often read at funerals. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And little did I know that inside 1 year, we'd be reading that Psalm at my son's funeral. Stuart was only 15 years old when he died, and he completed the suicide act. It was in my second year of sobriety, and I'll never forget the day. It was a Wednesday, and I got up and I was doing the stuff that I'd been taught to do. I got up and got on my knees and asked God to help me stay sober, relieve the obsession to drink, and I did the third step prayer as it's written. And my former wife had been out jogging. She came in and says, why don't we go get Stuart up? And I went down to his bedroom. When I walked down there, I looked ahead, and there's a rope hanging off of a pipe, and he is hanging from it. His feet were on the ground. I thought he's going to stand up and say, just kidding, Dad. But he didn't. I went over and held him, you know, and there's no first aid to be done, no CPR. He'd been dead a while. So I ran up, got my wife to call 911. Police came as a crime scene, but I did what I'd been taught to do. I called my sponsor. It's great to have a sponsor. And Pat said, I'll be over there immediately. You know, he came over. There's a lot of crime, lots going on. We're making coffee. And I can remember we sat down at the dining room table. And when we sat down there, a friend, a neighbor came over, John. And Robert says, Pat says, Robert, get your big book. So I did. And he says, open to 63 and give it to John. So we did the third step prayer. And John read it while we quoted it. And it goes like this, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as I will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. You know, I believe that prayer was honored that day. I didn't drink. That was good. But the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened as well. You know, I stand at the front window, I was looking out, and a friend, Art S., drove up on his motorcycle. Next, Matt E. pulls up in his car, and before I knew it, my home group was there, and friends that I'd known when I was in treatment at Mar. And so they were there, surround us with love. And when I think about it, it's a really special time. I mean, you can, Charles Dickens begins a book, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And you can understand with the tragedy and trauma of death of a child and the stigma that suicide causes, all those kind of problems. But when it says the best of times, when I think about the love that was shown to me and our family at a time of need, I'll never forget that, and I really saw that then, and I cherish that time at this point. I'd give anything for my son to be back, but that's not the way it is. But that was a special time. A lot of other things happened. You know, people helped us out. Death by suicide is particularly traumatic. It's a complicated grief. But people let me know about support you could get with that. You know, looking back, interesting things happened. At the time, it didn't seem funny. Now it's a little bit funny. But a guy sponsored called me up, and he was drunk. And his guy's name was Brad. So I answered the phone. I hang up that flip phone, put it in my pocket. Pat happened to be standing right there. And I told him, I says, why don't you go to Triangle Club, pick up a white chip. I got a lot going on here, and we'll deal with you later. And Pat looked at me, and he says, Robert, you're the luckiest guy in the world. I said, Pat, my son just died. He says, yeah, if anyone should be drinking, it's you, and you've got a sponsee out there drinking for you. And thinking back, it makes me realize how important it is to have a sponsor. They can see things a lot differently. You know, when I think about the things that have happened since then, and I want to wind up in the next couple of minutes, a lot of water has gone under the dam. I did go to that support group to get help around death with suicide, and it was called Survivors of Suicide, and it was led by peers, other people that actually lost people by suicide. It wasn't like a counselor telling you what you need to do, but it's by people who'd gone through the experience and sharing what their experience was. Not unlike 12-step recovery. And they had things to help you, things to read, and did some counseling, and you know, I went to those meetings a couple times a month, and after a couple years, they said, you know, Robert, you share pretty effectively about what you did to deal with the loss of your son, and we think you'd be good as a facilitator in one of these groups. And I didn't really want to, but I asked my sponsor, and he says, you ought to do that because you can communicate relatively well. So next thing I know, I'm helping facilitate those groups, and when there's a death by suicide and people want help, we might go in teams of two to share what people can do when this occurs. And so out of something that seemed to be just really challenging, it is something that really you can make use of. And you know, in the big book, in the family afterwards, it says showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing what makes life seem so worthwhile to us. Cling to the thought that in God's hand, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. So by helping others, you can avert death and misery for others. You know, my former wife and I had had challenges. Her picking me up at jail and detox and hospitals and all that kind of stuff can cause problems. Then the death of a son, of any child, it can cause more problems. We ended up getting a divorce. But I'm pleased to say that she found someone else. She's remarried, and I made amends. And I'm really lucky that I met Carrie, and we've been married nearly 10 years. It'll be 10 years in a couple months. And so, you know, life has continued. A lot of things positive happen. Since I got sober, took the 12 steps, you know, my sponsor told me I wasn't working. He says, you need to get a job. I said, get a job? You know, I was living off my wife at the time. And he says, you need to get a job. And so I got a job, and I found out, and this is really helpful if you're new, because since I got that first job, I've not only had a job, I've stayed employed continuously to this very day. But I learned some key things, and I learned it from guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's really important. So if you're in treatment, have a pencil, you might want to write this down. So what you need to do is you need to go to work, you need to stay at work, most importantly, you need to work at work. You get all three of those going at the same time, and you're really doing well. So I think when I sum up, I like to talk about purpose. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we say our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And so I'm uniquely qualified to like sponsor other alcoholics, to share a message of hope and recovery, how the 12 steps helped me deal with life. But I can be purposeful in other things, other areas of my life. So when I have a tragedy like Stuart's death, how can I make that purposeful? So the question I ask you, or the thing that I would want you to think about, is that once you've started living a purposeful life, it's hard to return to an ordinary life. Once you've lived a purposeful life, it's hard to return to an ordinary life. You know, I had that problem, that legal problem. You know, I was arrested for felonies, I was convicted of felonies. And so I was telling my story. I got to tell my story a little bit here and there, sort of like Steve was talking about. This guy asked me, he says, have you ever thought about getting a pardon? And I said, not really. And so he gave me a few clues about what I could do, and I applied for a pardon. About 16 months later, I went to the mailbox. It was April 9th, and I can remember that because it was the day before my sobriety date. And there was a letter from the Department of Pardons and Paroles, and I grabbed it, and I ran in and showed Carrie, and I said, this is either really good news or it's bad news. So I tore it open. And sure enough, I'd gotten a pardon. And man, I was running around. The next night, I was picking up a chip. And at my home group, I picked up a chip. And I showed it to everybody. And I went and saw my sponsor a couple days later. And he read this one sentence to me. And it's really interesting. And I want you to hear it. It says, whereas, having investigated the facts material to the pardon application, which investigation has established the satisfaction of the board that the pardon applicant is a law-abiding citizen and is fully rehabilitated. He said, they did not visit with me. So I think one thing you can take from my story is you can have tragic things happen to you, whether you're when you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just because you get sober doesn't mean that life's a bowl of cherries. But I think that if you're seeking God, you know, the third pertinent idea, God could and would if he had sought. I think if you're doing that, working the sponsor, doing the things that you're supposed to do, being a member in a home group, taking actions towards sobriety, that you can face the challenges of life. I really think you can do that. You know, that thing that counselor asked me, he asked me, he says, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you? Particularly for those who are new, that's the question I asked. Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you? I really do think it can. I'm going to read one last thing out of 12 and 12. When I was new, a guy that was running a beginner's meeting at Peachtree Corners would say, buy the big book and buy the 12 and 12, read it and reread it. And so I try and do that. But this is out of the 12 and 12 on step 12. It says, furthermore, how should we come to terms with seeming failure success? Can we now accept and adjust to either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable, satisfactions when the brighter, more glittering achievements are denied us? The A answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turn to good use for those who keep on trying to practice A's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, they can become facts of life for many more. You know, when Bill was in the working with the treatment center, he went back and helped other patients. And that's what a lot of people are doing here. They come back and help patients. And they do it because it helps their sobriety, and they're just trying to encourage you to do the same thing. So my hope is, if you're new here in treatment, do what people ask you to do. Go to a 12-step meeting, get somebody to show you the path they found. Because I really feel that the path is broad and it's wide. And anybody that's sober in any fellowship is willing to help the new person get sober. I am grateful for my sobriety today. I am grateful for many, many things. Most all, I'm just thankful to be alive and with you guys tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert, so much for sharing your story. As a token of appreciation from the Ridgeview Alumni Association, we have a spring fling shirt for you. All right. Thank you so much, Robert.